Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday, June 16th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And if anyone in the audience is here for Senate Bill 963, we will not be taking that bill up today. We will be carrying it over to our next hearing. So don't hang around if that's all you're here for.
So much disappointment, Madam Chair. It's palpable.
It didn't clear the room, so.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's be.
One's dead.
Let's begin by opening a public hearing and work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 18. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. SCR 18 honors Judy Hall for her invaluable contributions to the Oregon Legislative Assembly.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I do see Senator Winters is here on the next bill, but would you like to briefly speak on this one, and then we'll let you just stay put. And
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jackie Winters, State Senator, District 10, and I don't think I need to actually go into any detail about the accomplishments and the contribution of Judy Hall, who has served us senators for a long time and served us well. So I think that all of you are familiar with Judy and her work and with that. Unless you have a question, I will rest my case.
Okay. Okay, well, I think you're right. She needs no introduction. So thank you for bringing this to us. And members, we are in a work session. Senator Farioli?
Madam Chair, I move the SCR 18 be sent to the floor where they be adopted recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 18 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Senator Winters, would you be willing to carry this on the floor?
I'd love to.
Great. Okay, we'll have Senator Winters as our carrier. And I'll close the work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 18. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 969. And Erin, could you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 969 establishes Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing, requires report to Legislative Assembly no later than December 15th of 2015. Sunsets the Task Force on December 31st of 2016. This measure does have an emergency clause on it. We do have a fiscal statement on the measure. This measure will need to go to Ways and Means to be considered along with the other task forces, the agencies, Legislative Administration, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and Department of Corrections are all being asked to staff in this coming interim, so this will be considered along with them.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And we have our chief Senate sponsors here, so would you like to go ahead and tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, State Senator Jackie Winters with Senate District 10. And this is truly a bipartisan bill and that we're presenting today. And both the good senator and I had worked together on 3025. And in the course of actually that negotiation and work on 3025, it became clear that 3025 or ban the box was just only one piece of the challenges that exist when we talk about reentry of individuals coming from our institutions, our correctional institutions. And although recognizing that there is the Governor's Reentry Council, there is also, we believe, a need for the policy discussion in this building. The challenges that are there and barriers that exist for individuals coming out of our institutions are employment and also housing. I don't think you can talk to anyone that's in the field without recognizing if you're talking parole and probation, if you're talking to, they will tell you that it is a yeoman's task in order to get housing for those individuals. And I submit if individuals don't have a job, and if they don't have a place to lay their heads and to take care of their families, we're continuing a revolving door back into those institutions. So, you know, for me, it is trying to find some solutions to those barriers that are there so that truly we can actually talk about when we implement 3194, which this body passed, in order to lower the recidivism rate, that this will be another piece, hopefully, that will further reduce our recidivism and also reduce the cost. We're spending far too much money and far too much resources in our prison systems. And I think that both the good senator and I would have the objectives of trying to create taxpayers and through this initiative. So I will let my good colleague weigh in.
Thank you. I'm Michael Dembrow, State Senator for District 23. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland, as well as the city of Maywood Park. And as Senator Winter said, this bill came about, our work together on this bill came about flowing from the work on Ban the Box, where, you know, we realized that Ban the Box is an important step and in many ways a symbolic step, but it's just one of many, many barriers that ex-offenders face. As chair of the Workforce Committee, you know, we set as a committee goal to try to remove barriers for ex-offenders coming into the workforce. But as Senator Winter said, that's just one piece of the problem. Challenges with getting a job, challenges with getting education and training, challenges with getting housing, they all go together. And, you know, I think this bill, as is typically the case with task force bills, you know, really does a good job of laying out the problem and what the topics that will be covered will be. And so I think it kind of speaks for itself, as well as the people that we identified who need to be part of this conversation, because, you know, we really see this as a problem-solving kind of activity. There are so many frustrations that that people in this situation face. I've experienced them directly, not as an ex-offender, but as a teacher of many ex-offenders, you know, tried to get people out of very difficult positions through that they were in through no fault of their own. And just a typical situation, and we were able to address this at least partially last session, was the problem of somebody who leaves and wants to become an apprentice and enter a pre-apprenticeship program. Now, you can't enter a pre-apprenticeship program if you don't have a driver's license. Many offenders lose their licenses as part of their incarceration because they owe fines. They can't get their license back until they have repaid their fines. They can't repay their fines until they get a job. They can't get the job until they get the training. They can't get the training. I mean, it's just a really vicious cycle. We were able to deal with that just because of, you know, as the legislators that were working on it, getting people from different agencies into the room together and using our influence and authority to get a solution worked out. That, I think, is something that this task force, I think, will be able to do. Legislation will probably flow from it, but equally so, non-legislative fixes, I hope, will flow from it. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're hoping to do with this task force, and I look forward to being part of it if, in fact, it does make its way through the legislative process.
And, Madam Chair, you will note that we made the timeline a short timeline. That's on purpose because I don't like long, drawn-out task forces. The good senator's laughing. I want to be able to bring individuals together so that we can roll up our sleeves, similar to what we did when we first started 3194, to carry out that. And I think when you leave things open infinitum, you don't get the kind of work that you need to get accomplished. Also, we spent time in trying to identify, if you will notice, to make certain that it was the balance between the public sector as well as the private sector. You know, recognizing that we often discuss among ourselves, but that it's going to be very important that we include the private business community as well as the trades and those that will be affected and involved. We've got to, I believe, start having a greater conversation with both the private sector and the trades if we're actually going to be successful in getting truly individuals reentered back into society. The other piece, Senator Dembrough talked about employment. The housing, and I did talk to Director Van Fleet, because the housing is tremendously problematic, particularly when you look at some of the reasons why people cannot actually either rent, or if you're looking at Section 8, for example, and they have a spouse or a relative, and they're coming in with a prior offense, they can't stay with them because the regulation in the housing authorities are such that says you cannot have a felon there. So I think, you know, it's worth us beginning to look at those barriers and seeing what we may or may not be able to actually remove. I said it's interesting that we passed 3194 with good intentions to reduce our recidivism rate. However, if they're still in place, the barriers for one to be gainfully employed or the barrier that says a person can't have a place to stay, we will not achieve what we set out to do with lowering the recidivism rate in 3194. So I think we've got a lot of work left to do.
Okay, well, thank you both for bringing this to us. Looks like there is a lot of work to be done by this group. Did we have any questions for our senators? Okay, well, thank you again. And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 969 and open a work session on Senate Bill 969. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 969 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. And actually, that the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Farrioli has moved Senate Bill 969 with a do pass recommendation, and the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries, and this bill will move to our Ways and Means Committee, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 969. And next, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 971. Erin, would you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 971 provides definition for determining undeveloped portion of water right for municipal use, modifies conditions for issuing extension of time to perfect water right for municipal use, prohibits granting a water right certificate if legal status of extension of time required to perfect a water right is not final. You have two amendments before you today, Madam Chair. The -1 amendment adds an emergency clause to the measure. We do have a no revenue minimal fiscal impact on the -1. You also have a -2 amendment, Madam Chair. It replaces the measure, defines undeveloped portion of the permit, and extends time for putting water to beneficial use and determining such portion. For municipal groundwater and surface water permits, modifies conditions for issuing extension of time to perfect permit, removes provision in introduced measure prohibiting granting of water right certificate if legal status of time extension required to perfect water right is not final. We do not have the appropriate paperwork on the -2, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Erin. And I know Senator Roblin has been doing a lot of work on this, and we look forward to hearing about it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Arne Roblin, House District, Senate District, sorry about that. I'll get to reason why I said that, but Senate District 5. I became a House member in 2005 in large part because of the bill that caused us to be here on this bill. That one was 3038, and it had to do with allowing cities and municipalities and special districts to hold water rights for up to 20 years, as opposed to what at the time was a 5-year requirement. And I had been on a water board in which we were in a lawsuit for over a water right for about 6 years, and so the court found that we hadn't perfected it in the 5 years, therefore we lose our water right, and that made me add to the reasons why I decided to come to the legislature. Came to the legislature, worked hard on passing a bill. I will tell you, I was a novice, and I didn't really understand all of the things, intricacies that go into that. And so what happened was that bill, after being implemented, there was a lawsuit with regard to the implementation of that bill that had to do with beneficial uses of water and fish persistence. And that court case was finally settled in 2013 after going into place. And in the court case, they found that one of the conditions that had to be met was an issue with, from the department to look at the water right with the eye to fish persistence and some other issues. And so in the court, they said that the date of implementation of that particular portion of it was all the way back to 1999. And so anybody who had perfected a water right from 1999 to 2013 had some of their water right at risk, because in the years that followed the department, Water Resources had come up with their rules, and that was what was being litigated. And in their rules, they didn't have the fish persistence part. They had the 20 years and some other things. And so Water Watch had brought this lawsuit. That ended 2013. The court implemented that they had to go back and look at all the water rights that had been developed since 1999. Which put a number of municipalities and water right users in, at risk. That brings us to this bill, which was an attempt to try to figure out what we could do to hold harmless a number of cities and municipalities who were in the process. They hadn't finished the process. We sat, and my aide, Rosie Sheck, and I had to put her name because she gets embarrassed, doesn't want to be here, worked with a number of parties, Water Watch and cities, municipal, and special districts, to see if we could come up with a compromise position with respect to when this court case takes action. And so what this bill does is basically say that that date is 2005. I think there's an actual month and day, and I can't remember what those were. And so all of those districts that had perfected their water right between 1999 and 2005, and those that had already gotten their water right after that, that had been perfected, actually had been granted, are all okay with this bill. There are a group of water districts which happened, and they actually built things from 2005 to 2013. They are going to have to go back and look at their water right. The ones that have not been granted, fully authorized, are going to have the conversation again about when they go to renew their water right. One of the conditions will have to be fish persistence, and other things will be considered in granting of that water right, to make sure that the other beneficial uses of that water are taken into consideration when making the a judgment of the water right. This bill was hard fought. We got to different years and different times and a lot of different things over the last month and a half or so that we worked on it. There were conditions that were being put on one side or the other if we could extend it longer and whatever. And so we finally came to saying 2005 will be the date. And going forth, everybody understands what the rule is. The court was pretty clear about what had to be considered. So with that, you'll get to hear both from both groups, the Water Watch as well as the municipalities that have had water right issues, as well as special districts that do water rights. So I commend this bill to you. It is the result of a lot of work. I don't think either side is happy, but that's the way negotiations sometimes happen. And it is, I think, the product that we could come up with. So with that, that's what we have. Any questions? I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Senator Roblin? Senator Boquist.
Senator, you have, who are the winners and losers? There's obviously municipalities.
There are a group of municipalities and others who are going to have to use the new interpretation from the courts with respect to beneficial uses and fish persistence. And so there, the water that's in the streams that they're looking at trying to divert for our water rights are going to be limited in some will be limited, some won't. I mean, it depends on the individual cases. That's the problem with any of these water rights deals. Each one is a separate issue. You have to look at the conditions. Water Watch would say that the bill itself was clear and concise, and the courts found that to be true. they came with their decision, and so all of those people who are being grandfathered, those that have already got their perfected water right, and all of those from 99 to 2005 that haven't finished yet, but are in the process of getting theirs, all of those would be from their places where they lost. Those municipalities would say they actually won. So that's the combination of things that happened. So.
Yes, go ahead.
Obviously, Oregon Water Resources Department had something to do with this. You want to give a little background on that? Because that's where the complication and the twist comes.
Yeah, that's the part that makes it harder for me. They made a ruling, which I agreed with, and set some rules up in place. Those rules were implemented after the bill in 2005, and municipalities went on their way to try to perfect their water rights given that information. At that time, they decided, because there had not been many water rights perfected between 1999 and 2008 when this other stuff was going on, the ones that were in the works were working, but they put up basically a moratorium on new ones, so they just kind of left it to go forward. And in 2005, when the bill was passed, not only did they make the rules for implementation, they also decided that since there was this backlog of water rights conversations, that they would do it by watershed. And so they took the biggest watersheds first and moved out from there with respect to implementing the procedures. So a group of those that were in line to be first, they didn't take it in order that they asked for the application. They took it in order by watersheds. And I believe, and you can check because they're here, the in doing that, they took the Willamette River Basin is one of the bigger areas, and some of the smaller ones were outside. So people who thought that they might have come in earlier got put to later, but no one minded, everybody understood that this was an efficiency thing to try to get through the process. But in doing that, some people who have probably put their application in much earlier than others are in that group that didn't get done, so they're going to be in the position to have to put this new condition on their water permit. And some of them who had come in late but were in the right place got to do theirs first and may have already had it perfected, and therefore they're going to be held harmless. So the conversation with respect to how it was implemented did create some issues with and caused us to have a long negotiation.
And so Oregon Water Resources went through the normal rulemaking process, I'm assuming?
Yes.
And then their decision of what they were going to do
was that's where the lawsuit arises.
Check. And then those that got bumped to the end now have to pay the price for what the Oregon Water Resources Department did by rule.
You can ask them, but I would have to say that I agree with that statement.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Senator Farrioli.
So I understand that in my limited understanding of this issue, that there were some assertions that were made in 99 and 05 about prospectivity of the persistence of fish issues, so that the folks that made this protracted agreement, this discussion, all were in anticipation of not exacerbating the persistence of fish issue, but making it a prospective consideration, and that the court decision overturned their expectations. And I just want to
ask them for sure on that one, but as I followed that, I believe I agree with you.
Okay, good. well, not good. I
yeah, that's right.
I'm just trying to get the facts.
And when you talk to Router Resources, there are people here that could answer that more definitively than
sure.
I did.
So, just, Madam Chair, I guess I just wanted to assert that the courts is a separate branch of government, and the administration is in the executive branch, and we're the legislative branch, and everything that all three of us touch on is confounded to the point of distraction. And I remember somebody intended it to be that way. This bill would unscramble the situation by giving clarity.
That is true. I mean, I think that we may have felt in the legislature, at least part of us, that it was clear in one site. There were other people that thought it was clear in another way. The courts made that final decision as to what the clarity should be.
Well, it seems like it's our turn, Madam Chair. have you formed
this bill will agree with that clarity as described. It will allow a group of people who have already got their water rights under the old system, continue those, and it will, anything going forward, they're going to have to work with the PFAS system.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, go
ahead.
Who are
the proponents of the Dash 2 amendments?
I didn't look at the Dash 2s. Those aren't ours. I don't know the answer to that question.
Central Oregon cities, I believe, are the proponents of the Dash 2s. So,
I don't know much about the Dash 2s. I have not.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I don't see any other questions for you, so thank you for all your work on this.
Yep.
And we've got quite a few people signed up to testify. I'll start by calling Mark Landauer and Tracy Retton, if the two of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, representing approximately 950 special districts across the state, many providing wide range of services, including park rec, fire suppression, sanitary stormwater services, and, of course, municipal water. SDAO supports Senate Bill 971. At the outset, I'd like to thank Senator Roblin, Senator Hansel, Senator Prezonsky, and Senator Edwards for the amount of time and effort they've put into this particular matter. It's a very complex and difficult issue, and I want to thank them for their patience and understanding and work on this. There's a great deal of background that's been provided to the committee that is, I believe, posted on OLIS, but I'd like to just share with you some thoughts. The bill does three important things. First, it'll provide partial relief to some communities from part of the retroactive application of fish persistence standards that were created as a result of the Oregon Court of Appeals. Secondly, it clearly defines what is meant by the undeveloped portion of a permit. And finally, it makes it clear that the Water Resources Department cannot issue a water right certificate for municipal use if an extension of time is required and the order approving that extension of time is being appealed. Municipal water providers must plan 50 years, or even longer, to ensure that they have adequate water supplies to meet the demands of their communities. Those demands include residential customers for everyday use, as well as businesses who rely on our water to ensure economic activity can continue. We are required to meet the demands of our customers, so ensuring that we have adequate and predictable water supplies is critical. Furthermore, municipal water suppliers have every incentive to ensure that they use their water wisely. Our members are very sensitive to environmental needs. We have no interest in jeopardizing fish stocks, and our elected board members would be held accountable by the public if they did. Are there efficiency challenges in supplying nearly 88% of the state's population, 3.3 million ratepayers in the state of Oregon, of the state's population with clean and safe drinking water? Of course. Do we have leaky pipes? Yes. If we had the necessary resources to fix all the leaky pipes, we would do so because it makes no sense to allow expensively treated water to simply leak into the ground. But the truth of the matter is that we also have to be very careful to ensure that our water is affordable to all of our ratepayers. And replacing leaking pipes can be a very expensive proposition, but we do our best balancing these competing goals. Earlier in the session, it was mentioned previously that Senate Bill 712 was introduced by the League of at the request of the League of Oregon Cities and the Special Districts Association. That bill would have set the persistent standards to apply from December 11, 2013, moving forward. Water Watch strenuously opposed that measure, and when we appeared before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, we were directed to go and negotiate a compromise. We did meet, and we met in what I believe to be good faith. We met for over 25 hours. We explored many different approaches to provide relief to as many communities as possible, but in the end, our attempts to provide relief to all the communities that simply followed the guidance of the Water Resources Department fell short. As a result, Senate Bill 971 is before you for your consideration today. SDAO believes that it is a necessary solution to a very complex problem. I thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, I think we'll hear from both of you and then open it up.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here today on behalf of Oregon's 242 cities. I'll echo Mark in thanking Senator Roblin as well as Rosie from his office for countless hours of work on this issue. They've really been fantastic in continuing on with us through something that's been very complex and controversial and challenging. I also extend that thanks also to Senator Hansel and Senator Edwards, as well as to Senator Prasansky for their work on this issue. As you just heard, this issue is of critical importance to communities. It's, as Mark already indicated, although municipal water use represents approximately 6% of the total out-of-use water that is pulled from various water sources, it does provide water to approximately 88% of the state's population. Unlike other types of water users, such as agricultural users, municipalities, agricultural users and others have 5 years to develop their water rights. So they apply for a new water permit, and then they've got 5 years to complete the construction and put that water to full beneficial use. Municipalities are a little bit different in that they have a longer window of time to develop that water and put it to full beneficial use. Obviously, that's critical for community growth as well as for economic development. It's also in accordance with our local comprehensive planning efforts, which require long-term planning for both public facilities as well as a 20-year, at a minimum, 20-year water supply for communities. Due to our statewide representation of all of Oregon's cities, the League is in an extremely difficult position when it comes to Senate Bill 971. The bill seeks to provide a legislative fix, as you've heard, to a 2013 Court of Appeals decision in which fish persistence conditions were retroactively applied to pre-1998 municipal water permits. Essentially, this bill does draw a somewhat arbitrary line in the sand with the effect of creating winners and losers amongst Oregon communities who are all in a very similar situation. And here again is where our position becomes incredibly challenging as a statewide organization. This bill does leave a handful of communities, or potentially more, out in terms of providing a fix and creating certainty for future water supply and public investments that have been made to deliver that water. However, failure to pass some form of a fix would be incredibly detrimental to other Oregon communities. I think it is important to understand just some of the history that created this challenging situation. This really has been an issue where winners and losers were first created as a result of how long it has taken those municipalities to get through the process of getting an approved extension of time after 2005. As you heard from Senator Roblin, from 1998 until the passage of 2005 legislation that first implemented fish persistence conditions, there were not many extensions filed or processed due to the Water Resource Department putting many extension requests on administrative hold in 1998 in order to adopt new rules and seek a better way of processing those extensions. This was followed by a court case, Coos Bay North Bend, which followed several years later, and further called into question how long a municipality has to develop their water. So essentially, from 1998 until nearly 2006, there was not much going on in terms of processing municipal water right extensions. Once they did begin to process those again, following the legislation that passed in 2005, they had a considerable backlog, as you can imagine, from the many years of not having any processing going on. And they began to process those extensions in batches based on the geographic location, as you already heard. There are still actually 35 requests that have yet to be processed from Eastern Oregon as well as the South Coast of Oregon. They are still waiting. I know one of those is Ontario. They had filed their paperwork in 2010 prior to the court's decision, and they're still waiting to have that extension approved by the department. Other extensions are still pending and awaiting review from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. If a municipality was allowed to or provide the opportunity to get an approved extension after 2005, but prior to the court's decision in 2013, they would have received the benefit of the law as it was being administered by the department. If they were last on the list, or have yet to be processed, they are now subject to significant retroactive conditioning of water that they may have been using for up to 20 years. I know Senator Roblin mentioned 1999. For I know the city of Philomath, it goes back to 1993 for them. This bill impacts those communities who are not able to get through the process prior to the court decision. Hypothetically, the 2005 date means that for a community who built a water treatment plant in 2004, they are probably breathing a very huge sigh of relief right now because 2005 is very helpful for them. Now, if it's a similar community and they built that treatment plant in 2006, they're probably feeling pretty nervous right now by this bill because this does not protect the public investments that they've made and it doesn't protect their future water supply. Again, these folks made these investments before the court's decision and did so in accordance with the Water Resource Department's administrative rules and guidance. I want to quickly address the issue of Cottage Grove because they are what led us to where we are today. They are a little bit unique in terms of their situation. And something that Mark mentioned that the bill does is close what is a perceived loophole, which indicates that if you've got an extension that has been protested, that you cannot go get a water right certificate while there's still a pending protest on the books. So this would close that loophole. It would prevent that from occurring in the future. But really what we're focused on today is a small subset of impacted municipalities and whether they should be held to a different standard than those that were able to get through the process prior to the 2013 court decision. And you have before you a handout of all the communities that do not have an approved extension yet and that are therefore likely to be impacted by this bill. Those with the star asterisk next to their name are those that we are aware of who may be negatively impacted. So as you'll see, there's a handful of communities, and quite frankly, some of them we're still trying to figure it out, and they're still trying to figure out what all of this means. I know for the city of Carleton, they're wondering if they have data that supports their water use in 2005 because their extension was being reviewed in 2009. So there's a lot of factors here in terms of how this impacts communities. And thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Just as an example, and you mentioned Carleton. Good news is they do have data because they spent over $2 million between 99 and 2004 in that system. So, I mean, that's a deal, but that doesn't help with the bill. But I think my better question to special districts in the city is that it's a fine list, but is there a cost estimate that a municipal water system or one of these water systems might anticipate this mistake of state government is likely to cost? Could it be anywhere from a few thousand dollars for a fish study to millions?
Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Boquist, it's very difficult to provide that information because until the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife actually provides the municipal water permit holder the actual restrictions that they're going to place on the amount of water they can that they have to pass for the persistence of fish, we don't really know what that impact from a financial standpoint is. I can tell you, though, for example, one of our water districts located in Clackamas County called Oak Lodge Water District is a member of the North Clackamas County Waters Association. They created a water treatment plant prior to 2005, but they expanded it subsequent to 2005. They spent $10 million at the beginning prior to 2005, $18 million after the 2005 date. So that expansion doubled the ability of the treatment plant to double its capacity. So until we really know the amount of water that ODF&W restricts for the persistence of fish, we really can't quantify the dollar value that may be that may be jeopardized.
Go ahead.
Is there even one example? But is there one example in the state that can tell us? I'm looking for a dollar figure for one example.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Boquist, I have similar examples to Mark's of what has been invested in infrastructure, but I believe, and I'm going to look at him now, that the city of Bend might have some numbers of what it would cost in terms of the perceived compliance with the actual conditioning if it would have applied to them retroactively.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made mention in my understanding of this, and the good news is I kept my files, and there's five of us here. We're 2005, so we might be ahead of the judge, obviously, is that we obviously, or somewhere in there, erroneously told the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife they should go do something. And you made mentions they're going to do the survey. Do they charge the cities for this survey? Or do you have any idea who pays for this work that ODF&W is supposed to do? If you have idea, that's fine.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Boquist, I believe that the Department of Fish and Wildlife conducts the fish persistence based on their general fund and license fees. So they do it within their existing budget.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is a fee and service agency, and this is the issue that, ironically, we had on the floor less than a week ago, where in 2000, the Joint Audits Committee recognized that the Fish and Wildlife was outspending fee-for-service money as if it was tax dollars and revenue money. And so therein relies the problem, probably with Oregon Water Resources, too, is not having the funds available to do either the fish study or to process the applications. And now here we are 15 years later trying to patch this back together. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you both for your testimony. And next I'll call Jonathan Manton, Lisa Brown, and Eric Kanzler. The three of you would like to come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm wearing two hats today. I'm here with Water Watch of Oregon, as well as a steering committee member of the Oregon Conservation Network. I want to also echo some of the thanks that were uttered before we got here. It has been an exhaustive process. We have been in these closed-door meetings throughout this entire session, going back to February. Many of the issues that have been brought up in previous testimony, I think Lisa Brown, who's here with me today with Water Watch, can respond to, but I just want to make a few points. It's been a hard work, and we have been in the room debating very complex areas of water law for several months, and we finally got to the point where people around the table could say, okay, we're not going to fight over this bill by setting the date of 2005. So we lifted the Oregon Conservation Network major threat, which was on the original bill, Senate Bill 712. The dash twos would throw this back into chaos, frankly. We go right back to a big fight if that's the case. The compromise that's here is not something that we're necessarily half about. This is a give on Water Watch's part and on the conservation community's part, but it's not something we'll fight over if the date is at 2005, which is when the law was passed. It's not an arbitrary date there. That's when the original law was passed in 2005. We've spoken a little bit about winners and losers already. What hasn't come up yet are losers that are the fish, and not just the people, not just the fish, but the people who catch the fish and the communities and the commercial interests who rely on those fish. We're talking about when the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife makes a determination that conditions are necessary for imperiled fish to persist. And at what point do those conditions not have to go into effect? Can cities and water users be let off the hook for complying with conditions that there has been a determination that are necessary for that fish to persist? The later we set that date, the more of that water is not conditioned on the, doesn't have to comply with those conditions. The later we set the date, the more imperiled fish we lose. The later we set the date, the more anglers lose. The later we set the date, the more commercial interests who depend on those fish lose. The Native Fish Society, the Steelheaders Association, Trout Unlimited, all of the Oregon Conservation Network has been watching this closely. I had not asked them to be here today because we were at a point where we got to this setting the date through this hard negotiation at 05, such that we thought this was just going to move forward. A change in that would certainly bring all of them back to the table, and the entire 50 members of the Oregon Conservation Network, I imagine, would be interested if we would move to the dash twos after all this process. At that, I think I'll just lastly just kind of mention that when this law was passed in 2005, it was supported by the League of Oregon Cities as well as the Special District Association, and that then interpretations carried forward, and we had the lawsuits, and it's been tough. But here we are. We can't support the bill as it is, but we won't fight over it, and that's what I can share with you. We can be to neutral the bill as it's written. And I think Lisa can maybe rebut some of the other things that have just already been stated today and share a little bit of the history that's helpful.
Yeah, I would just emphasize again what...
Could you just say your name for the
I'm
record?
I'm sorry. Lisa Brown with Water Watch of Oregon. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. I would reemphasize what Mr. Manton said, which is that, you know, the 2005 date is not arbitrary. It's when the bill was enacted that put both the fish persistence standard and also the water management and conservation planning standard into law. And whereas the Court of Appeals opinion would require both fish conditioning and water management and conservation planning from whenever the last permit extension expired, which in some cases is in the 90s, this bill would move that date to 2005. And so there are real rivers and fish that will lose protection under this bill. But we do think it's a bright line. It's a much more workable standard for the cities. We're willing to do that to make this work. I did want to address Senator Boquist's comment about the rules process and the administrative rules, and I wanted to emphasize that the rules that the Water Resource Department enacted to implement this statute, the House Bill 3038, are not inconsistent with what the court found. In other words, that those were fully vetted and brought about the result of the court case. So that's not an inconsistent. They weren't directing people to do something inconsistent with what the court ultimately found. I wanted to touch a little bit on this issue of timing and delay, and certainly different cities and different districts are situated differently, but it's really important to understand that in the court case that brought about this bill, what had happened is that the city had purposefully delayed the processing of its own application. It had put its own application on an administrative hold while it pulled all the water through the system with the goal of not having to do fish persistence and not having to do water management and conservation planning. So it's important to understand that was going on, and that was a big loophole and that needed to be addressed. I believe it was also Senator Boquist that brought up the example of Carlton, which I think is an important one to discuss. Carlton has a 39% leak rate. It leaks 39% of the water that it diverts out of a stream that is an important stream for listed steelhead and other fish. And so I think it's an important example in that, you know, the fish persistence conditions that have been added to these permits, and there have been about 55 or 60 extensions issued with fish persistence conditions, those conditions have proven workable. And when you look at a city with something like a 39% leak rate, there's room. There's room to make it work for fish and for the cities. And we think that this bill can strike that balance. I agree with Mr. Landauer that nobody wants to leak that kind of water, and we're hoping that this compromise can sort of be a springboard to working with the cities and the districts to address conservation and efficiency and things like leak rates. We're hopeful that might happen still. And I guess another comment about Senator Boquist's question is that the statute actually requires ODFNW and the fish conditions to be based on existing data. That's in the statute. So there aren't sort of new studies or costs of new studies that are borne by either ODFNW or the applicant. If you're talking about going out and conducting like a fish survey, if you look at ORS 537-232, it requires it to be based on existing data. So that was in the original bill in 2005. So it just, that goes to the issue of costs. So I guess in conclusion, I would just say, the 2005 date does create some real impacts on rivers and fish, but we can get to neutral as it being a workable solution moving forward.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the City of Bend, here to support Senate Bill 971. Bend developed significant water rights between 1999 and 2002, about 2.5 cubic feet per second. And without legislation this session, as a result of the Court of Appeals decision that was mentioned previously, that that activity would be subject to standards that weren't implemented until 2005, 3 years after the rights were developed. Back of the envelope calculations estimate the cost to us at probably starting around $1 million, potentially significantly more. That's largely an artifact of our need to mitigate in the Deschutes Basin based on the basin-wide mitigation program. So it's not something I would extrapolate to other parts of the state, but it is a very real cost for us. The retroactive application of the 2005 standards, obviously, for many of us, most of us weren't anticipated. In 2005, they clearly couldn't have been anticipated in 1999 to 2002. We didn't have a crystal ball at that point in time. Would we like a 2013 date? Frankly, we would very much. We'd love to see a clean, bright line based on the date of the court decision, which changed practically everyone's understanding of the law. However, we see this as one of those cases that we so often see in this building of not letting the goal of the perfect get in the way of what's possible. We know that fish persistence standards apply going forward. This will cost the city money. We're fine with that. We're very supportive of and frankly deeply invested already in the health of the Deschutes River, Tumalo Creek, from which the city draws a portion of its water supply. And we're also deeply invested in collaboratively planning to meet future needs for all users in the basin, including in stream needs for fish, through innovative programs like place-based planning that we hope will be funded this session. Our position on the bill isn't about the environment, however, it's about fairness. Fairness, if not for all cities, then for as many as you are able to help. Again, we're supportive of the bill and we thank you for your time.
Okay, any questions? Yes, Senator Boquist.
I just need to clarify a couple. The testimony from Water Watch. So what you're saying is the cities are all at fault, not the Department of Fish and Wildlife or the Oregon Water Resources, right? Is that correct?
I don't believe I said that, no.
Well, then clarify yourself.
Which part of my testimony?
Well, first you said the cities were at fault for who didn't take the right action and not the Department of Water Resources, and that's why they didn't get their water permits. The second thing is you talked about the fish status at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and if you'll recall correctly, we, the legislature, reversed the law since 2005 and decided that the fish are in all streams and we now have to prove backwards. So I'm looking for clarification of whether you're indicating that Oregon Department of Water Resources didn't do anything because the city said don't do anything in all cases, or is there some equal ground here?
Senator Boquist, I think maybe there's a couple of points in my testimony to clarify. One was just to clarify that the rules that were promulgated by the department were not inconsistent. I mean, were consistent with our reading of the statute and the Court of Appeals reading of the statute. So I just want to clarify there wasn't a conflict between the rules and the statutory interpretation there. The second point, I think, is that in the permit matter that gave rise to the Court of Appeals opinion that is now giving rise to this legislation. That particular city requested that its extension application be put on administrative hold while it diverted the full amount of the permit, which enabled it to, under their reading of the statute, not have to undergo a fish persistence review and not have to develop what's called a water management conservation plan, which is the other critical piece of this statute that, you know, I think we can all agree is good for Oregon. So I wasn't trying to make any kind of general statement about the cities versus WRD. I was just using that particular example. And I'm not sure I totally understand your third or your second question there, if you could maybe restate it.
Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, it is not your problem, but I'm trying to get clarity here. So, Jonathan, I'm not really trying to beat you up. I'm trying to figure out exactly what's going on here, because somebody made a mistake, right? And Oregon Fish and Wildlife, of course, is a fee-for-service agency. And then later, if you don't know, we did reversals. We, the legislature, at one point said, we're going to go out and find all these streams and determine which have fish and which don't have fish. And I think if you required exactly like we did to water resources, we didn't give them any money. And then we've now since then said, okay, we're assuming that there's fish in most of these locations. And we've done a 180-degree turn trying to fix our own thing. It's the legislature who probably did most of these things and not you guys, not the water resources, not Fish and Wildlife. But my point I'm trying to get at here is that there's a cost involved for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to now go do this. And they even have to go out and determine if there's fish. We assume there's fish in all streams now, basically, under the law. We reversed that. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, where are the costs associated? What are the sorts of costs we need to do? You know, how is that mitigated? And what are the financial consequences? And I don't think you guys really know. Jonathan has got even growing, because I'm thinking that, you know, not so much the date of, like, somebody needs to pay the bill. And it might be the state that really needs to pay the bill here.
Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Boquist, thank you very much. Yes, I think that I don't have much to add to that, except for just maybe a little anecdote from what we were negotiating over these last few months in these meetings. Because I think the tone of this hearing has been, frankly, a little bit more maybe negative than to where we got at the end of these conversations. And one of the things that we were able to get to throughout this process is that we want to continue this relationship between the parties that are at the table now and that we're just here. We want to work together in the future. One of the areas that we've identified that we know we need to work together on is better funding for all of these issues. So, you know, as we address the plight of cities and counties and local governments, and as we address the needs of both the people and the fish, we want to work together. And if there's ways that we can support requests through the Ways and Means Committee to do that, then we want to continue. I think there was actually goodwill built up in this conversation, and we want to continue that goodwill and work towards funding solutions too.
Just one follow-up. Okay. And really more of a point, and that is that it is not unknown to the state of Carlton's water problems and the leakage rate. The question is where do you come up with the bonding, the financing, and the stuff to fix that leakage rate, which has been ongoing for decades in terms that's out there and that sort of thing. And that's why I look at the list and it's like there's winners and losers, but the question is the losers, how do you come to an agreement on that? I think Jonathan hit the nail on the head here, because there's a little fault sort of everywhere between the legislature and the agencies and everything else like that. We, the legislature, has been very good since 2005 to say, yes, go do this, but then we're not going to give you any money to do it. And as you point out, then the judge looked at it and said, that's not my problem. You said, go do it. Just kind of where we're at. And so I'm familiar with the problem. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions for you, so thank you for your testimony. We have two more people to testify, and I'll call them both. It's Mike Fries and Doug Riggs. If the two of you would like to come forward. For waiting so patiently.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization, and this debate harkens way back to 1999 when we started talking about water conservation and mitigation. For those of you who've been here a while, and many of you have, COCO has been at the table on trying to create a basin-wide plan in the Deschutes that would be responsible in putting water back in stream and protecting fish. So fish persistence, even though we don't call it that, has been at the top of our agenda. I want to make a few points here. There's been a lot discussed so far. This bill and the Dash 2 amendments really are essentially about fairness and parity. The bill, as written, creates clear winners and losers, and one of the cities in our district in particular, the City of Sisters, is a very big loser in this bill with the arbitrary date that's been put in. This is generally unfair to cities and, that are trapped by this, but specifically unfair to the City of Sisters, which has been an active part of the solution in the Deschutes Basin. I wanted to point out a few things. Sisters and other cities will work collaboratively with COCO, with the Deschutes Water Alliance, the Deschutes River Conservancy, Friends of Whiteches Creek, et cetera, and collaboratively doing good things for rivers and stream flow in the basin. As I mentioned, in 1999, in 2001, in 2003, 2005, and in 2011, we worked with many of you to pass a series of bills to create the Deschutes Groundwater Mitigation Program. That program specifically allowed cities to use their existing river water or surface water right and leave that all in stream in exchange for a much smaller amount of groundwater. And it was done with the collaboration of all the parties in this building. It was a bipartisan set of amendments that passed both in Democrat and Republican control, was signed by Democrat governors all throughout the process. We have also been at the forefront of things like xeriscaping, which is preserving water for landscaping. We have all adopted water management conservation plans. My cities have spent thousands of dollars lining canals and trying to pipe canals to prevent leakage that we've talked about, et cetera, et cetera. So we've been at the forefront of all this thing. The long and short of this is that we have seen a dramatic increase in stream flows in the basin. Stream flows in the middle of the Deschutes, which is from Bend northwards towards Opal Springs, the PG project, have quadrupled since this project began. That's good for people. It's good for fish. Whiteches Creek has largely been restored. We are working on fish passage to comply with the Endangered Species Act, and the City of Sisters has been at the table in negotiations with all of this. In fact, in 2011, we hosted a tour with Senator Dinkfelder and the Environment Committee of the Whiteches Creek project, and she saw the beginning of the project, but we've done great things since then. A number of points that I wanted to, a couple points I wanted to make about the 2005 date. The 2005 date is completely arbitrary. It's arbitrary because it sets a date and it says that even if you were in the process prior to 2005, you get no credit. So my cities were in the process, were delayed for a number of reasons we've talked about today in getting approved by the WRD, didn't get approved until 2009 to applications we submitted back in 1999 and 2002 and 2003. So a date of 2005 is saying that you should have retroactively somehow known prior to that date and time that the persistence of fish issues were going to be passed by this body in 2005, and that's arbitrary and that's simply not fair. Another point I wanted to make very quickly, Senator Roblin and others have mentioned that we're trying to deal with water that's diverted from streams. The City of Sisters isn't diverting any water from a stream. We left our water in stream, and our water right is a groundwater right, but we are still required to comply with the persistence of fish requirements in this groundwater right. Now, that may or may not be appropriate going forward from the date of which we're told that would happen, but it certainly is not fair to go retroactively after we've done good things by leaving our in-stream water right in stream. So I really appreciate the committee taking the time today. All we're asking is that cities that in good faith acted based on the best information that was available at the time from the department and from this legislature in 2005 or 2002 or 2007, not be unfairly singled out. And that's what Sisters and a few of the other communities are feeling like. We're being unfairly singled out and saying that group of cities, they get off the hook, that group of special districts gets off the hook, but this small rural city in Central Oregon, which has a limited budget, a small population, and has been dramatically affected by the downturn in the economic recovery over the last few years, is suddenly going to come up with hundreds of thousands of dollars in possibly a decade or more in delays, lawsuits, appeals, to comply with regulations that were imposed by a 2005 bill that came after we submitted our application for use of this well. So I appreciate your consideration of the Dash 2 amendments. I think it's only fair. It puts a bright line in the sand that says that everybody from the court decision on will have to comply with this in all cases, and that's fair. But people who in good faith were acting prior to that date will not be forced to comply with something that they were not anticipating and probably cannot afford. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, Mike Fries. I represent Associated Oregon Industries. We represent approximately 1,500 businesses and who employ roughly 200,000 people. Not unlike the League of Oregon Cities, we're in a unique position. I'm here really representing the consumer base that have kind of not been part of these conversations, I don't think, to probably the extent that they should have been. And I take some responsibility for that. But what makes us unique is that there are a number of municipalities that are covered. Those same municipalities serve many of our members by the 2005 date. Unfortunately, however, you've seen the list. There are a number of municipalities that are not covered under the 2005 date. Those businesses, and we're still trying to figure out who and how much water who the businesses are and how much water they use and what the potential impact is on those businesses. For instance, if you're a brewery or if you're a winery and you need access to that water, then that potentially either puts that water use under certain constraints, or it most likely will increase your water rates. In cities like Carleton, which is a good example, there are a number of infrastructure issues across the state. AOI has been at the table trying to figure out how to make those important investments with limited dollars. We will remain there and we'll continue to try to work with the legislature to do that. This, however, puts an additional constraint on certain cities based, again, what we believe is an arbitrary date. What we're asking for is, again, because we're in a unique position, that certain municipalities, meaning certain businesses, are protected by the 2005 date. In reality, it should be the 2013 date that's identified in the Dash 2s. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, any questions? Senator Boquist?
I have a curiosity question, as you mentioned out there. I mean, I think there's just three or four cities. They're the only three. There's two North Clackamas, Carleton, Sisters are kind of the really ones that are impacted, is my observation. So it's only three or four that are impacted by this date. Just any guess? Anybody out there want to nod? Or nobody has a clue, really. Five. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I also understand that that Hood River may also be compromised, which we have a number of members there, as you might imagine. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I think that's correct. I think it's a small number of cities, which is why I'm a little bit baffled as to why we couldn't just set the date as of the date of the court decision. I don't think the impact would be great, and especially in cases where, you know, cities were in a good faith effort trying to comply with existing law. And I do want to comment on a question that was asked earlier. I was in the negotiations on Senate Bill or House Bill 3369 in 2005, and the persistence of fish regulation discussion drug on for weeks and weeks. And at the time, we were repeatedly assured by the department, by the governor's office, by the advocates in the room, that this would be a prospective effort. So any city, like many of my cities in Central Oregon, which had already been undergoing their efforts to certificate their water right and had existing applications pending at the department, they would not be impacted. And that came up again and again and again. I didn't particularly like the persistence of fish issues that came up, and we ended up neutral on the bill as a result of that, but we were assured that this would be prospective. So I think that is an important point. At the time, that was a very active part of the discussion.
Okay. Madam Chair, just for the record, I've sent staff scurrying in my office by my email because I have my files from 2005, and my recollection is that same sort of, assurances. And if you recall back then, I was in the House and we were in the majority. So it's not like And some people nod, you know, fish wasn't exactly really high on the list over on that side at the top. So I'm not sure what happened. That's what I'm kind of trying to figure out. And the same, Madam Chair, if like there's like five, how do we help the five? How do we do mediation for the five? That's
the dash twos.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
I do, Madam Chair, but the questions are for a previous panel.
Oh, well.
And because I wanted to hear about the dash twos before I asked the questions of the previous panel, so the folks from Water Watch and
okay, we can ask them to come
if
back.
If you
up.
Don't mind.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Go ahead, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think I understand the persistence of fish question and the obvious obligation not to dewater streams so that critical and endangered species can persist. I think that's the underlying objective of the whole persistence of fish question. And it makes a great litigation strategy because if you feel that persistence is injured, you can litigate. That's one of those situations where you don't probably even need standing to litigate. You just need a stamp. When that persistence of litigation strategy encounters an activist judge, you get a retroactive application of the rules of 1999, which puts you in front of the legislature, because that is not workable. So we are now looking at sort of three strands of the same question. Do we leave the 1999 retroactive application in place and harm everybody that had agreed to the 2005 legislation? Or do we accept the bill as it is and leave stranded four or five cities that proceeded with water development applications after 2005, probably right up to the present date? Or do we adopt the dash two amendments and have activists running around the building on the House side, ostensibly, if we were to pass the dash two amendments on the Senate side, which is entertaining. And, you know, it gives you something to do. And in the closing weeks of the legislative session, provides a little drama, which is something that we're desperately in need of around here, because it's not going to get busy enough. But the thing that I really am having trouble getting my mind around is in the situation of the City of Sisters, who traded in-stream water rights for groundwater. How in the hell do you apply a persistence of fish issue to a municipality that is using groundwater for their municipal system? That's my question.
Thank you, Jed. Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Farioli. I think Lisa can look up the City of
Could
Sisters to maybe
get. Could you introduce yourself again for the record?
Certainly. Jonathan Manton. Thank you. And I think Lisa's going to look up the City of Sisters, because each one of these is a different instance, certainly, and maybe have some more detail about that one. Obviously, we would not agree with the characterization of the litigation strategy and that notion that we just wouldn't have difference of opinion, I think, on that. The 2005 date, I think the basis for that is that's when this law was passed. And I don't know of any other situation where we decide that a law doesn't go into effect until the Supreme Court has determined that it's to be upheld. You know, this was a case that was litigated by a trial court and then the Court of Appeals, and then the Supreme Court heard oral arguments and decided to let the Court of Appeal decision stand. So I think we set the we don't pass laws in this building. Legislators don't pass laws in this building and then wait for them to go effect until the Supreme Court has decided that that's when they take place. And laws usually go into effect when they're passed, and that's the basis for setting the date of 2005. And I think that's what just makes sense.
Madam Chair, that's fascinating. Doesn't answer my question. We have, I'm extrapolating from testimony, but I would guess that the purpose of trading a large in-stream water right for a smaller municipal water site water right served by wells in part, is to create a safe harbor for the city. So how is it that we are now being told that the persistence of fish issue attaches specifically to Sisters, which traded its in-stream water right, and has stated it won't access its in-stream water right, for a municipal well field? How does the municipal well field water right, a reduction in that water withdrawal, affect the persistence of fish?
Senator Farrelly, the fish persistence standard enacted in 2005 does apply to groundwater where it is hydraulically connected to surface water. And as we know from the USGS study in the Deschutes, there is a one-to-one relationship between, you know, if you pump a gallon of groundwater, you diminish the stream flow by a gallon. So presumably that determination was made, that this was a hydraulically connected well, and pumping the well would, if, in fact, impact stream flows in streams where the persistence of fish would be affected. It looks like the City of Sisters has certificated a good portion of that permit already, so that would not be subject to fish persistence conditions. They had 1.5 CFS undeveloped as of 1999, so presumably somewhere less than 1.56 CFS undeveloped as of 2005, and that would be the portion that would be subjected to what, again, have proven to be very modest fish persistence conditions. I mean, these, with the exception of I think, South Fork Water Board, who didn't pursue this line of arguments, none of the 55 or 60 cities who have had fish persistence conditions placed onto their permit extensions have challenged those conditions.
I'm sure that's really not relevant to the question that I asked.
I'd like to restate.
Well, I don't think we're going to get to the answer. I mean, the question that I'm trying to get at is there seems to be no safe harbor, even for a municipality that switched off its in-stream water rights for a well. And I do understand the notion of hydrological connection, but if the stream flows have increased, in some cases up to fourfold, if there are hydrological connections that we have to use mathematical formulas to calculate, wouldn't that make more water available for the cities? If the in-stream flows are increasing because of the conservation issues that are mostly voluntary, that are going on, that have been going on for more than a decade, I mean, we've been arguing about the Deschutes Water Basin Management Plan, and every year that we're in this building, there's more and more conservation goals that are set and more that are being reached. I don't necessarily see that it's a wise strategy to insist that municipal well fields be subjected to the whole concept of persistence of fish. So, Madam Chair, I guess if there is a point to the ramble that I'm obviously embarking on at this moment, it is that there is no safe harbor, there is no end of litigation. The date of 2005 leaves a whole set of cities stranded on the wrong side of a date that may have a very logical underpinning. But as far as I'm concerned, if we solve the problem with this bill, which is here for a possible work session, we leave unresolved the issue for five cities, that two of which are, believe it or not, in my district. Clackamas County is in my district, and so is Sisters. I mean, that's hard to fathom. I have to look at a map to believe that it's true. But the fact of the matter is I don't see the harm in the later date because there is no safe harbor and there is no satisfaction that the environmental community will admit to, notwithstanding the fact that there's been a significant increase in stream flows and as a direct result of voluntary compliance and cooperation. So, Madam Chair, I guess the issue for me is if people want to have a dust-up over the Dash 2 amendments, and the best you can get to is neutral with the bill as it is. Let's go for the desktop.
Madam Chair, two quick points just to, for my good friend Jonathan, which is, he is accurate in saying, you know, we don't pass legislation anticipating court cases two or three long arms, but having since all five members of the Senate were here in 2005, I would just suggest for the record that most of us read the bill, look at the common wording of the bill, and think we understand the legislative intent of the bill, and that's how we vote on it. Many times the court tells us later that's not what we intended, even though we're the ones who voted on it. So I would agree with Jonathan and his analysis, but then the five of us also look at bills differently and vote differently every day on how we interpret the same language of the bill. So
only four of you were here in 2005.
Okay, the record's correct.
You weren't here then, huh?
Senator Beyer was not here. Okay, I don't see any other questions for you, so we'll let you go. And I think that this bill reflects the complexity of water law, the lateness of the session, and the lateness of the hour. So for today, I think that we'll be all on this bill. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 971. And with nothing further to come before us, members were adjourned.
And I have to go cut hay. It's been entirely too. And I have to go cut hay. It's been entirely too.
Adjourned.